From the studios at Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on the news that made headlines around our region this last week. And today, our panel includes Carly Flandreau, reporter with Idaho Ed News, Kyle Fonensteel, reporter for Idaho Capital Sun, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, and our own Troy Oppie, host of All Things Considered, right here on Boise State Public Radio. Hi, everybody.
Hi, Gemma. Happy Hello. Friday.
Happy Friday.
Hi, Happy Friday, everybody. All right, Troy, I want to kick it off with you, and I want to go head north. Let's talk about Valley County in particular. What happened with their EMS bond? Can you first, before we get into all of the details, tell us about why the county wanted this bond and what it would be for?
Yeah, so the brief recap on this is the existing funding mechanism and structure of emergency medical response in Valley County is tied to the fire districts that are contracted to provide those services by the county. The levy rate was set about a decade ago. It largely relied on a volunteer EMS personnel model. Volunteers have largely dried up. The county is obviously growing like everywhere is, and they've found it hard to support the EMS needs of that area within the current structure. The county has been pulling about $1 million a year out of its savings the last 2 years to subsidize those EMS costs so they can keep things going. The fire districts have pulled money out of their own budgets, which McCall Fire Chief Garrett DeYoung told me compromises fire readiness. And so they had gone to the voters with two questions. The first asking to restructure emergency medical services in Valley County to create a countywide EMS district that would have its own governing board. They would pull that control away from the county commissioners and give it to this new three-person governing board, a volunteer governing board. That needed a simple majority to pass, and it did by an overwhelming margin. So that part of the process is going forward. Mm-hmm. Voters came 65 votes short from paying for it all. And Valley County was asking to more than triple what residents and property taxpayers up there currently pay for EMS services. Right now, for a median priced home in Valley County, it's about $41 a year. The proposed levy that failed on Tuesday would have jumped that to $135 a year for the median priced home. And that would have put a fully staffed professional ambulance in every city in Valley County and added a fourth as backup. And so now you have the new structure created to oversee EMS in a different way than it has been, but there's no new money to pay for it. And where this comes in is, I talked to McCall Fire Chief Garrett DeYoung, and he said, you know, we can maintain the status quo through 2024, but we have, you know, we're now on the clock to get this figured out. I have a clip of him that we can play.
We can go back to the voters in May for either a permanent levy override at a 2/3 or a temporary at a simple majority. And that's going to be the big question. Do we, you know, swing for the fence or try to play it a little more safe and let the new board get their feet under them?
In the coming weeks, the county commission that will appoint this board, and they'll be elected in future terms, but the county commissioners will start putting together this board that will help decide what their next steps are. The emergency levy that Chief DeYoung mentioned, there are some legal questions I've been told that the county needs to work through before they know if that's a viable option or not, but it would be temporary. It would require only a simple majority to pass in May if they put it on the ballot, but it would only provide funding for 2 years at a maximum.
So Troy, what about this idea of tourism? And I want to bring this up because when we look at Valley County and permanent residents, it's small. Right. Then you add in the tourists and then you add in people who have their second homes up there. Right. So what about that effect on this community's needs? And what about this idea that where do tourists come in terms of should they have to put money into emergency services?
And this has been the major point of contention throughout the bond process. There wasn't a lot of public feedback or even negativity around the bond issue. But what was there was a concern that residents are bearing the brunt of this cost for emergency medical services that are in a lot of ways used significantly by tourists and people who don't live there and aren't paying for it. The county says that, you know, they are trying to work with the state to figure out a way that they can create some sort of fee mechanism for, you know, that would shift some more of this cost to tourists. But they have a lot of work to do. Here is Valley County Commissioner Sherry Maupin.
We are trying to work with the state, finding the best methods to create opportunities to try and find fees that our visitors could pay in our resort communities, most particularly, to help pay for the services that are being required to put into place to work with our visitors. That's really the whole conversation right now.
And that's going to take some legislative work in upcoming mm-hmm. sessions. Ketchum, for example, has a lot tax, the local option tax, sales tax override, and they tax some lodging and alcohol by the drink purchases. They, in the city of Ketchum, the way they have that structured, some of that funding can go to emergency medical services. It's not clear exactly what options Valley County might have to use a funding mechanism like that. They say that they can't issue a new sales tax countywide to pay for that. And that's one of the things that I'm working on that will be part of a story next week.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so can we dive into that just a bit then, Troy? I mean, so if Valley County can't do something like that countywide, right, like the city yeah. of Ketchum has done, let's take the city of McCall. Could the city of McCall, without legislation, be able to do what Ketchum is doing? I mean, they have very similar populations.
They do. And anytime you're going to propose or change a local option tax, you do have to bring that to the voters. So it would end up on the ballot. I would not say, and this is some of the research that I'm still in the process of mm-hmm. doing for this reporting, but they are not interested just because the problem is bigger than that, right? It is countywide, and especially in this new structure with a countywide EMS district now, trying to do things at such a local level. I don't think that they're interested in that specific a solution. They're looking to do something with a bit broader brush, so to speak.
So Troy, how do they move forward, at least until May, because that's the earliest they can bring the levy back on to the ballot, is now they have this new board, right? This countywide EMS board.
They will, yes.
So what do you do with that? I'm assuming they start in January. I mean, what can they do, if anything, if there's no funding?
The Commissioner Maupin told me that they'll start the process pretty quickly of identifying and appointing these new commission members. So it may be before Christmas, but they'll have some work to do because they do need to decide which direction they want to go. They do need to answer those legal questions if an emergency levy is appropriate to fund EMS services for the next 2 years. Chief DeYoung says funding is in place. We can keep going. We can maintain through 2024. It's once they get beyond that, that there would be an issue of there simply wouldn't be enough money to provide mm-hmm. the current level of service. But it's going to start with getting these members of the new Valley Countywide EMS district appointed, and we should see that in the next 4 to 6 weeks, I'm guessing.
And I would assume, Troy, it's got to be very disheartening to have come just 65 votes shy of that and having to go all the way back now to the drawing board.
It is. Chief DeYoung told me that they're optimistic because it was so close, that baseline mm-hmm. level of support is there. There were several dozen voters who approved the creation of the district but did not cast a vote for the funding of it, which I thought was an interesting discrepancy there. But the timing that they had, and this I think is similar to what happened in Ada County with the bond to expand the mm-hmm. jail that also failed by a narrow margin. Neither one of those bond issues or levy issues were on were before voters much at all before the election. We're talking just a couple of months. And typically that you are hard pressed to be able to educate your voter base at a wide enough rate to have a successful supermajority turnout for you on election day. So I think if they're going to put something back on the ballot in May, you're going to see a lot more effort well ahead of that election to get the word out and educate the voters up there.
Well, really appreciate your reporting on this, Troy, and we look forward to your more in-depth reporting on this as we move forward. So appreciate that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So, Carly, a fire devastated Highlands High in Pocatello last April, and my understanding is that school administrators were hoping that they could go to their taxpayers and ask them to get on board to help rebuild the school. So what happened on election day? Because they put a bond, a school bond in front of voters, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So they put a $45 million bond on the ballot. It would have improved Highland High. That's where the fire was last April, and upgraded the gym facilities at a second school, Century High. But voters, they had 56% approval for the measure, but that fell short of the required two-thirds supermajority.
Okay, so you have spoken to some of the school administrators at this point. What have they said about missing this supermajority?
Yeah, so they had a special meeting on Wednesday, the day after the elections, to kind of go over their results. And one of Highland's administrators said, you know, waking up that morning, Wednesday morning, and finding out that the bond had failed was every bit as disheartening as waking up to the fire on April 21st. And they were just discouraged because the insurance funds will basically pay for an exact rebuild of Highland as it was. And this was a school built in 1963. And they're saying, you know, this is really outdated for a number of reasons. Back in the 1960s, Highland didn't serve freshmen. There wasn't a girls' basketball team. So they were hoping to use this bond to not just rebuild Highland exactly as it was, but to improve it. And the students at Highland, they've had a really tough couple of years. If you think of a senior at Highland High, their freshman year at Highland was hybrid because of COVID. Their sophomore year was somewhat typical. Their junior year was the fire in the spring, which meant that they were remote for a while. And then they were hybrid and sharing a neighboring school, which was Century. And then this year, they're a bit displaced as well. Students are having to travel to different buildings across town for classes. So they were hoping to be able to project a return to normalcy fairly soon for those kids. But now they're realizing for many of the kids in the building right now, they'll never see their full school again.
Mm. So, Carly, I don't mean to sound very really simple and kind of maybe dumb or uninformed about this, but I'm sitting here thinking, okay, this school, you know, was devastated by a fire, right? All you have to do is drive by it. You can see that. Kids aren't going there, right? As you just talked about how they're going, you know, sharing other school facilities, et cetera. Why then would taxpayers say no to rebuilding a school when it's very obvious that the school needs to be rebuilt, that these students have been displaced? I mean, am I missing some nuance here?
Well, let me clarify something. So the entire school didn't burn down, but a big chunk of it did. And so students actually are back in the building this school year. Last school year, they had to share with another school, but this fall they were able to return. But some facilities, you know, are gone, like the band and choir rooms and a gym and the weight room have been impacted. So anyway, students are back in the building, but it's not a fully functioning building. And bond critics, they spoke out saying that the district wasn't transparent in its communications. And that's partly because of House Bill 292, and that was a property tax relief bill. And so critics felt like the district should have explained that a little more, that a bond failure would mean big tax relief. And what the district did do is explain to voters that the tax relief would offset the cost of the bond. And so they characterized it as a net zero tax impact. So critics didn't like that. They also questioned the need to build a bigger and more revamped school. They said, you know, enrollment levels have basically been the same or have had little change in the last 13 years in the Pocatello-Chubbuck School District. So they questioned the need to add more capacity to the school. So those were some of the critiques about it.
Okay, well, I appreciate that clarification. Scott, some sad news about Chris Tapp. Now, folks who aren't familiar with Chris, he was wrongfully convicted, spent 20 years in prison. Scott, can you pick up the story from there? And can we also, though, talk about truly, I mean, the consequences, the serious consequences of wrongful conviction?
Yeah, this is really just a tragic story all around. It's really kind of unbelievable. But as you said, Chris Tapp was an Idaho Falls man who was wrongfully convicted of the rape and murder of 18-year-old Angie Dodge in Idaho Falls in 1998. He was sent to prison. He spent 21 years in prison, which is nearly half of his life and, you know, almost all of his entire adult life. He was released from prison in 2017 following concerns that his confession had been coerced. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But then, sure enough, in 2019, new investigation of DNA evidence showed that, as most people suspected, the DNA did not belong to Chris Tapp. And in fact, it belonged to Brian Dripps, who was then subsequently charged with Angie Dodge's murder. And so Chris Tapp was exonerated of the murder officially in 2019. But then he died last week. He was in an accidental fall in Las Vegas, suffered irreversible head injuries, and then died on Sunday at the age of 47. So a really tragic life that was cut short in an accident. And making the story even stranger, in August, his wife, Stacy Tapp, she died in a car accident. So it's just an incredibly tragic story all around. Brian Clark, the Statesman's opinion writer, he's based in Idaho Falls, in Eastern Idaho. And he's covered Christopher Tapp's case and interviewed Christopher Tapp while he was still in prison. And he wrote a really interesting and really good column this week, reflecting on the tragedy of the situation and really talking about how there have been very little consequences following the discovery that Tapp was wrongfully convicted, and particularly that his confession was coerced. There are a few things that states and other jurisdictions do, like having a conviction review unit or a conviction review board to make sure that there are not coerced confessions or prosecutorial misconduct that happened in this case with Tapp. But we have nothing like that in Idaho. Similarly, believe it or not, Idaho does not require interrogations to be video recorded. And that was really what got Christopher Tapp released from prison, was the realization, the review of those interrogation recordings showing that it was indeed coerced and that he did not indeed do this act. Still, we have not had any of those types of reforms that would prevent something like this from happening. Now, I will point out that Tapp did settle with the city of Idaho Falls for $11.7 million in a settlement after he sued the city, but he had to sue the city. And the state did pass legislation that compensates Idahoans who are wrongfully convicted of crimes, $62,000 for every year of wrongful incarceration, or $75,000 for every year wrongfully on death row. But those are kind of post facto, those are after the fact measures that are available. And really, there's nothing set up to prevent another situation like Christopher Tapp. And again, being in prison for nearly his entire adult life, and then his life ending tragically in an accident cut short at 47 is really just a tragic end to this whole story.
Yeah, it's just heartbreaking, Scott. It really is. Kyle, can you talk about an audit that happened at the Idaho State Health Department? So apparently they found some flaws in how the department distributed some federal grant money. So what does all this mean?
Thanks. So this summer, an audit from Legislative Services Office found flaws in how the State Health Department distributed $72 million in grant funds that were meant to help school-age children recover from pandemic-era learning loss. The audit found that a lack of controls in the state agency led to funds being spent for things they weren't allowed to be spent on. The State Health Department disagreed with all of the audit's findings, saying that it distributed the funds legally. And the director just recently told the auditors that it would not submit plans to correct their actions. This has been a really long and complicated process, but essentially there's been two responses to the State Health Department's actions here. One is the legal response, which the Idaho Attorney General's office has been working toward in the courts, and the other is a financial response from lawmakers. We heard some news on both those fronts this week, which have been in the works for over the course of the year. It's not clear what either response is going to look like, but we're getting an early look right now. The co-chairs of Idaho's powerful budgeting committee responded pretty firmly to the audit this week. Idaho Falls Republican Representative Wendy Horman said the Department of Health and Welfare's response, quote, calls into question our ability to authorize funds for the agency. Senator Scott Groh, also co-chair of the committee, said agencies are expected to follow the law and that the committee now has the responsibility and the opportunity to respond from a financial standpoint. On the legal side, the civil subpoenas that the Idaho Attorney General Raul Labrador issued against the Department of Health and Welfare and an ex-department official were withdrawn this week. Those were asking for records on the grant program under investigation and for more information about employees that worked for the program, but also asked for a lot of information, like what charitable organizations employees donated to. The special prosecutor in this case, Christopher Boyd, told an ex-department official that he withdrew the demands because the audit answered key questions the demands were looking into. And he says he's looking to appoint a special inquiry judge to look into whether there was a crime or corruption involved. So all that's to say that for both the legal and fiscal response, there's a lot left in the process.
Okay. And so that's basically, we'll just have to kind of wait and see what happens with the legal process.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thanks, Kyle. So Troy, I want to talk about go back to Election Day and the Boise City in particular and District 3 city council race. Now, my understanding, and we talked about this earlier in the week, is that the person who won the election, I believe she won by 15 votes. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, Troy. So what's going on in regards to a possible recount or not?
So Josh Johnston, who came in second in that four-person race for the District 3 City Council seat in Boise, says he will ask for a recount. He cannot do that until canvassing is completed next Tuesday. But once that happens, he's issued a news release late last night saying he did plan to ask for a recount. One interesting note about that race, as I was talking to Ada County Clerk Trent Triple yesterday, was that on election night, we were watching this race closely because it was close the entire way. And we got to the point where you had 16 of 16 precincts reporting in, and the two candidates had the exact same number of votes. It was a tie. And a little bit later, the numbers changed, and Kathy Corliss ends up with a 15-vote margin of victory in the unofficial results. The reason why that happened was because the last change in the voting total was because they counted the day of returned absentee ballots. So the last batch of ballots that were counted did not come in from the precincts. Those were absentee ballots picked up from drop boxes and the post office that take longer to be processed at election headquarters compared to the results from the precincts that are largely coming in electronically now. And they bring the hard drives back and just plug those in and they're done. So that was one of the unique aspects of that race. As we were looking on election night and we saw a tied result with all precincts reporting and then a change in Kathy Corliss ending up the winner of that race.
So Troy, who pays for a recount?
The margin of victory was outside of the automatic recount threshold, which is a tenth of 1%. And so it would fall to the Johnston campaign to pay for that. Previously, when candidates have asked for a recount, they might choose specific precincts to be recounted instead of going for the entire District 3. It's not clear if Johnston is going to ask for the entire district to be recounted or if he'll specify precincts.
But as you said, this can't happen until canvassing is finished. So this won't even happen until at least mid next week at the earliest.
Correct. Yeah. He does expect once that request is made, it could happen. The recount, it could happen by late next week, but the timing is not firm yet.
Okay. So Scott, let's talk about two Idaho newspapers that are closing. But I think, I mean, not only is that unfortunate, this is a trend that seems to be happening all over the country.
Yeah, I don't want to be a downer here on this beautiful fall Friday. I'll try to end on a high note on this. But yeah, two newspapers we just in the last couple of weeks have closed down. I spoke with Mark Steele, who is the publisher of the Caribou County Sun in Soda Springs in eastern Idaho, outside of Pocatello. And he and his wife, Wendy, have been running the Caribou County Sun for 48 years. They bought the newspaper when they were in their 20s in 1976. And they've been running it for 48 years. He estimates he's attended 1,000 or more city council meetings over those 48 years. however, over the last 3 years, revenue dropped by 40%. Really making it untenable to continue running the paper. He couldn't find a buyer for it. He had a couple buyers on the line in 2019, but those fell through. And then the pandemic hit and really just kind of quashed all of those plans. He had a couple people retiring on staff that he was finding hard to replace. And he's 74 years old and he's ready to be done. And so he closed the Caribou County Sun as of October 26th. Around the same time, the CUNA Melba News is ceasing to be a title. The owners of the CUNA Melba News, Adams Publishing, which owns the Idaho Press, announced that they are folding that title and wrapping CUNA News into the existing Meridian Press and rebranding as the Meridian CUNA Press. And yeah, like you said, this is part of a national trend. Over the past nearly 20 years, 2,500 newspapers have closed. In just 3 years, from 2019 to 2022, 360 newspapers closed, almost all of them weekly newspapers, community newspapers like the CUNA Melba News and the Caribou County Sun. And it leaves a real question as to what does a community lose when they lose their newspaper? You know, you lose that sense of community. But you also lose this watchdog. You know, like I said, Mark Steele, he covered over 1,000 city council meetings, and that watchdog role is really important. There was a study in 2018 that showed that when a town loses its newspaper, the cost of government goes up through borrowing costs and the cost of services. That's because nobody's watching. Other studies have shown that communities lose, that there's a greater spread of misinformation, there's lower voter turnout, and there is a lower trust in democratic institutions when a community loses its newspaper. So like I said, I'm going to end on a positive note with this story. You know, Mark and I, we reminisced about, oh, I used to own the CUNA Melbourne News. So my wife and I purchased the CUNA Melbourne News in 2006 and owned it for 5 years until 2011. So the closure of that title really hits home for me. It makes me very sad to see that name go away. That's a newspaper that started in 1982. And I'll point out that CUNA had a newspaper since 1914. Soda Springs in Caribou County had a newspaper since 1900, even before Caribou County was a county. Soda Springs used to be part of Lemhi County. And so these are long traditions. But Mark and I reminisced about how difficult it was to put out a weekly newspaper. You've got to lay out the paper and design it and send it to the printer. I used to hand insert ads. If we had ads that were inserted in the paper, I would go and hand insert them myself. Labeling the papers, picking them up at the printer, delivering them to the post offices and the convenience stores and doing all that, and which we loved. And it's a labor of love. But without those, the flip side of that is that without those costs and that burden, you actually have a lower barrier to entry. You can start a website and have a digital only website, news website. And the local news initiative at Northwestern University points to some successes that are out there in small communities that are replacing their community newspaper with digital upstarts. It still remains to be seen whether there's a feasible business model for that. But if there is a glimmer of hope, that would be it. And Mark Steele told me that that's his hope. Now that he's closed down, he's hoping somebody will come in with maybe a digital product or move in with an expansion and start something up that will sustain and keep Soda Springs and Caribou County a community instead of a town, as he says.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do appreciate that ending on that hope, because I think there are some days, Scott, where we don't have enough of it. So I really do appreciate that. Carly, let's go back to election night and school bonds, because the little school district of Shelley, Idaho, and a lot of people may not know where that is, but it's right outside of Idaho Falls. I worked in Idaho Falls back in the day. I've been to Shelley, and they had a pretty big ask for voters. Carly, can you talk about that a bit and kind of what they're going to do next?
Yeah, it caught my attention because it really is a tiny community. They're surrounded by farmland. Their mascot is the Russets. Their current high school is known as the Spud Cellar, affectionately by locals. And on this last ballot, they had the state's largest education funding ask, which was a $67.8 million bond. And they wanted to use those funds to build a new high school with more classroom space, because their current high school is too small. There's about 9 classrooms that exist outside of it. They're in places like modular add-ons, a building that was meant to be a concessions building. But the measure failed with just 48% approval. And so that's far short of the needed 2/3 supermajority. So now they're having to go back to the drawing board and say, okay, what can we do? Are we going to run this bond measure again? Are we going to add more modulars? Are we going to have a mobile teacher who puts her classroom on a cart and goes from one room to the next during other teachers' prep periods? So they've got a board meeting next week, and they'll take that question up to see what their next steps are.
So, Carly, you wrote a really interesting article talking and looking at all of these school bonds and levies that were on the ballot on Election Day. And talk a little bit about what you found out, because the bonds didn't seem to pass, but most of the levies did.
Yeah, so supplemental levies, those are for extra funds for things like salaries or classroom materials, and they have a lower threshold to pass, which is usually a simple majority. Mm-hmm. So 10 of 12 levies on the ballot passed, and both bonds failed, which was the Pocatello bond and the Shelley bond. And bonds have a required supermajority approval, and that's one of the most stringent thresholds in the nation. So in Idaho, bonds are more likely to fail than they are to succeed. So looking at those two bonds, I think there's a lot of interesting state takeaways. So one thing is that the legislature's House Bill 292, which provided property tax relief, and earmarked some funds for districts to put towards existing bonds or levies and pay those down. But that bill doesn't seem to be helping school districts pass bond measures. We're also seeing that messaging about bonds is more important than ever to voters. Districts have to be really careful not to advocate where they could end up with litigation, like in the case of Idaho Falls. They've got to be really transparent, and they've got to work hard to dispel misinformation that can pop up on social media. We're also seeing more organized opposition groups, like local watchdog groups and even political action committees, that are paying close attention to these school funding elections and can have big impacts on their outcomes. And taxpayers just don't seem to have the stomach right now for these multi-million dollar requests. And in Pocatello, we saw that play out both with the bond failure and with the election of a trustee who vocally opposed the bond, Raymond Knopf, who will step in as a trustee this January.
Okay, thanks for that update. Kyle, I've got about right under 2 minutes, but I really want you to talk about this. So this is a watchdog report that found that Idaho built few accountability measures when it created the health data exchange. I know it's not a lot of time, but can you explain what's going on?
Of course, happy to. So the Idaho Health Data Exchange is a service meant to make health data more widely available for medical providers. It's supported by about $94 million in taxpayer funds, filed for bankruptcy in fall of 2022. But what a new report released last week found was that part of how it was created was created and managed made regulation of the exchange difficult. It was created as a non-profit corporation by a state commission, and Idaho law didn't spell out clear accountability measures for the exchange. A lot of states have health data exchanges, but how they look varies. Some are parts of the government and some aren't. But the report noted that states that pursued a government partnership with a private company like Idaho did had more regulations than Idaho did for the companies. Legislators on the Budget Committee heard the report today, and a few things stood out. A service like this is needed. One legislator, Senator Kevin Cook, who served on a task force studying Medicaid this summer, said that that's what he's heard from providers. He said the exchange was a good idea, but it sounds like some serious mistakes need fixed. The legislature does have options moving forward, but it doesn't look like it can shut down the exchange, which is a private corporation. The Finance Committee's co-chair asked about that in light of the report's finding about issues with how security for health data on the exchange was reviewed. And then there's also the state government created nonprofit issue. Idaho law is unclear about whether state entities can create nonprofits. And the state is working to develop a list of nonprofits funded by the government, saying it's clear that, with one legislator saying it's clear that the state needs more oversight into nonprofits created or funded by the government.
All right, Kyle, I appreciate that update. Thank you all. Carly Flandreau, reporter with Idaho Ed News. Kyle Fonensteel, reporter for Idaho Capital Sun. Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman. And our own Troy Oppie, host of All Things Considered, right here on Boise State Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on the Black experience. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.